Oh, hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin? Welcome to another Tech Lounge with me, Christian Schiller. This episode is a sort of perfect Tech Lounge episode. It's retro technology. It's technologists that have been around for a little while and have a good sense of perspective. It's talking about a book. It's talking about Apple. A good combination of all sorts of things I find interesting. It's an interview with the wonderful writer John Buck and his book, Inventing the Future, which is an inside story of Apple's Advanced Technology Group. And these are people you may not have heard of, even if you've been using Apple devices for a while, and they created a lot of groundbreaking technologies, some of which very much so still have their influence today. So it's a fascinating interview. Possibly a perfect companion to this episode and this interview is Setapp, an app subscription where you get a variety of wonderful applications for a monthly fee. I use Clean My Mac, I use Timing, I use Receipts, I use Better Touch Tool. There's several others, but that's already getting the value, I think. And there's many, many more. It also works on iOS with some apps that if they're compatible. And frankly, I find it fantastic often when I am looking for something, like I wanted something to be able to manipulate the brightness on external displays. And there's a few options for this, but there's one on Setapp. If you want to try Setapp too and throw the show a few cents, then head on over to go.christianscheller.com/Setapp.
Yeah, I'm on the wrong camera, but I just...
That's okay.
I switched to the work laptop.
Non-Tahoe laptop.
It's been a weird network issue where suddenly the network disconnects. I had it a little bit before.
That's cool.
It seems to be worse. It seems to be something to do with the random IP address
recording.
Feature.
Okay.
All right. Yep. I will. Yep. It's actually still recording. So I think this is a good intro anyway. So
yeah.
Welcome, John. It's actually kind of interesting. We had to abort the first recording. Yeah. Because of macOS Tahoe, which has been controversial.
Technology.
But you're actually on to talk about slightly different era in Apple's history. But maybe let's begin with a little bit about you. I think you're a writer and a journalist for some Australian media, but maybe let's have a little bit of an intro to what you do.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for the invitation and to join the lounge and have a drink. So I was one of those lucky people who at high school knew what he wanted to do, and I studied typing at high school and wanted to be a journalist and ended up working in a newsroom at one of the Australian broadcasters and worked as an editor there, not a writer, and I worked with the journalists to create their stories. And it was a nightly show that had 4-minute stories. And this comes back, if people are listening and wondering why I'm going so far back, It's valuable for later on for story selling, because I did that job, which was at a pretty fast pace, and there were no computers and there was no digital editing. It was all just very manual on tape machines. And then fast forward, I moved to Sydney onto the east coast of Australia, and I got a job on a TV show pre-internet called Beyond 2000. And that was this widely syndicated across 70 countries around the world TV show about technology, medicine, science, updates for people to watch every week. And it was a huge hit. And I would be editing, picture editor on that. And after a couple of years, they sent me on the road to go and do the stories with the journalists and produce them, which meant I got to travel all around the world on someone else's dollar as a single man with 3 other single guys.
What could possibly go wrong?
And I got to Berlin at one stage. What could possibly go wrong? And we had to get 23 stories, and we were away for 9 weeks at a time. We'd come back for 9 weeks, then back on for 9 weeks. So it sounded great initially, but then it gets a bit of a drag. But I was lucky that I got to visit General Electric in the US. I got to visit Siemens and big companies in Germany, all across the UK, all through Canada. And oddly, I got to go to Apple into their advanced technology group in 1993. And little did I realize that decades later, I would be writing a book about that very group of people, even though that was a long way ahead. So after I'd been editing for a whole bunch of time, I'd moved to China with my wife and family, and we lived in Beijing for a number of years, and I didn't have a work permit. So I started writing. And there's, you know, it's a fabulous world. You probably won't hear this view of China very often, but I've got a lot of time for China and what they've done for their people. And it's also, there's no Facebook and there's no Instagram, and it's fantastic. and you get a lot more done. But what I did was I wrote some books about editing, and I tracked down people and spoke to them about why they'd done what they'd done. And some of the people I spoke to from my book were working at Apple at the time, and they are the guys who worked on the QuickTime team. And they said to me, oh, yeah, this is great, and we've enjoyed reading your book, but there's all these other stories that nobody's ever told. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, we were part of the advanced technology group, and we can't really talk about it at the moment, but one day we'd love to talk about it. And I think what they were saying was, when Steve's not around, not that anyone thought he would pass away so young, but they thought once he had left the company, they would be free to talk, because most of them had already left the company themselves, but they were still scared of him and terrified of him decades after they'd quit the company. So just by chance, I started talking to one of them, and he said, there's a guy in, and they're all like super, super overachievers since, you know, one was rewriting the code for Spotify, one was running the back end for Twitter. Yeah, and these are all super smart people. And Eric said to me, oh, you've got to speak to so-and-so. You've got to speak to Steve. And then I would speak to Steve, and he said, oh, you've got to speak to so-and-so. And I started collecting all of these stories. And I thought, okay, how am I going to make this interesting to anyone else? And so I went back to, you know, the ability that most editors have of working in a non-linear fashion, getting these different pieces and putting them literally on a timeline, and thinking about, okay, how can I make this a compelling story? And so, you know, I just did it on a Mac, like, you know, you and I are both using now. I just did the whole thing in just plain text, notes, and published the book 2 years ago, and now I'm in a process of just updating it every sort of quarter.
It's because I only heard about it recently, but it's been out for a couple of years already. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's been out for a couple of years, and of course, what happens is people contact me and say, "Oh, I've got a story for you," or you know, you didn't. Yeah. So it's ever growing.
It's amazing how people never really come out the woodwork until you actually put something out there. Unfortunately.
That's very true.
Let's just go back a step very, very quickly. So I think with the film editing, you have six books, actually, Timeline 1 through 6.
Make
YouTube videos, nothing particularly complicated, using tools like Premiere, etc. But I just sort of wondered, like, I see Timeline 5, 89 to 94, there's a screen grab, actually even 84 to 89, there's a screen grab that looks, I don't know what, it's Avid. It looks even vaguely familiar to what people might be used to now. But these kind of tools like Final Cut, Premiere, etc. When do tools like that actually enter, and we might see something we're vaguely familiar with now?
Okay. Well, 88 is when Avid built the first one that is able to play back some clips. And I don't know if you know, but Randy Ubelos was working at a company called Supermac, and they made video cards.
Toaster, was it Toaster? That was the Amiga.
That's separate. Toaster is new tech. Yeah, that's Amiga. But he worked for Supermac. They made these cards, and he was in the background. He said, oh, look, I want to write a little bit of basic software so you can demo the cards. And he created this thing called Realtime. And then suddenly Adobe found out and said, we've got to hire this guy. So they hired him, and he wrote Premiere. And he wrote Premiere 1 through 3. And then Macromedia was one of the flushes in the pan in that era. And they said, come over here, we'll pay you double the money Adobe are paying you. And can you write this thing called, he wrote this thing called Key Grip. And then Macromedia really stumbled. Media 100 tried to buy them. They stumbled. And then Apple and Steve Jobs rang them and said, right, bring the whole team over. We're going to spend $50 million on advertising. And that was Final Cut. Randy is tangled in there with all of that. And then he went on a holiday. At the same time as he's writing Final Cut, Steve was not convinced that they could deliver it, and he wanted something for the FireWire iMac when they debuted that. So he hired another guy called Glenn Reed who wrote iMovie completely separately, separate office. 3 years later, Randy goes on holidays for a scuba holiday, takes all this video, doesn't like iMovie when he gets back, so he rewrites iMovie and finishes that, then writes Aperture. So it's what struck me the most about the lineage of all these editing people is none of them knew anything about editing. They were all you know what I mean? Like, so what you're doing with, you know, and what my sons do, they don't know anything about editing. They just know that they want to do whatever it is they want to do.
Yeah.
And so I think things like iMovie are amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and if you were editing pre-Avid, if you're editing on film, Gone with the Wind, Jaws, you name a film you can think of that was edited on film, iMovie as a system is more complex and can deliver a lot more than what they were doing on flatbed film editors. So
does iMovie still exist? Like I remember doing a lot of things with, it does,
Yeah.
And I remember iMovie, iDVD, even GarageBand, like on the music front. GarageBand is amazing. I recorded like three albums on GarageBand.
It's remarkable, right? And I think it gets back to that democratization of equipment. And a lot of what I spoke to the guys at Apple about was they would always look 10 years out and be forever frustrated with what they could physically build and sell. And now with what you can do on a phone is absolutely remarkable. And you're right. There's not a lot of love for iMovie and TikTok and Instagram and everyone else has their own video.
Which is kind of amazing that it's a commodity.
And they all do.
Video editing is now a commodity. It's like almost any tool that has video has some kind of basic scrubber interface for even, you know, YouTube has it as well. Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and I do a bit of lecturing at the Australian Film and Television Radio School and to the editing and the editing cohort. And everyone starts off by asking me, do you use Premiere or do you use DaVinci or do you use this? I said, look, it doesn't matter. You should be able to do this all on iMovie because the name of the game is
is
the storytelling. Exactly. And I sound like a grumpy old guy who's been editing forever, but it actually doesn't matter what the equipment is, because if you can get out, you know, like you say, you're making a video. If you can get it out, you know, in a fashion that is suits your audience and how your audience wants to consume that content, that's far more powerful than sitting in DaVinci and color grading and spending hours.
And I think you know, we see this with platforms like YouTube and TikTok, and there's people doing very well and. Yep. Professionals will criticize their audio and their video, but most people don't care, you know. So,
of course. No.
I'm often.
I do think at some level, which is what I say to this editing cohort of 20 year olds, is it's such that good enough is not a job anymore. You're going to have to be really good and polished. So my dad would always say to me, why do people pay you a bit more to be an editor? I said, well, if you take a car to a car wash, you usually have three options and they clean it and then they put some wax on it or they detail it, right? And if you're going to sell that car, if you just wash it, you'll get a certain price. But if you detail it and fix the tires up and fix all the inside out and put some nice smell in there, you'll get more money for the car. So I say to these students, you've got to become a car detailer. That's the gig, right?
Yeah.
I think. You know.
Let's transition into the inventing the future, but we haven't actually mentioned the title yet. Let's transition through QuickTime because I think it's a nice connection. And
yeah.
I mean, QuickTime, as far as I'm aware, is QuickTime still in macOS? I feel like it is still there. QuickTime Player is still there, but
There is a player, but yeah,
it used to be very powerful in itself. A lot of these technologies we're going to talk about. I've been using Mac since the late 90s. Yes. You've been using them, I guess, at least the same amount of time. A lot of these technologies we're going to talk about, people may not be familiar with. So QuickTime sort of still exists, but at its peak, what was it?
At its peak, it was the first platform that Apple built that could also be used on a PC to record and play back video as a software-only process. So up until QuickTime was released, you needed hardware to make up for the shortcomings of the processors that video needs. And when it came out, the images were the size of a stamp. But it got to the point where it was standard TV, kind of the size of a laptop. And then from then on, the processors were able to do it all. But it sort of predates, but it's on a similar level to, say, Apple Music or Apple iTunes, in that it brought in many, many people from the PC world into using an Apple product.
Yeah.
And that the reason why the book is the way the book is, so I've done 1981 to 1991, is that I'd met by this stage all the QuickTime team who built it and worked in a separate building because they thought if they were in the separate building, no one could axe the project they were working because no one would know they were there. And which is crazy, right? But when Steve Jobs came back, when they sold Next into Apple, he got rid of all of the advanced technology group, every single person, every project, except for QuickTime. And I think QuickTime, for him, he realized the value proposition of this software-only tool that they could use,
especially in video, the late 90s.
Video streaming.
Yeah. I mean, I was using it to put together very early postage stamp videos of band recordings and stuff online.
And they were doing like those 3D things.
QuickTime 3D,
Remember that? So there was a lot of crazy stuff. But so then I thought, okay, well, I spoke to the kind of the theme of the book is not really, you know, it's not really about Apple. Yeah. It's about these people and where they come from and what they were doing when they grew up. And all of them, just about all of them, they're nearly all Americans. They're nearly all men. But they would say to me, oh, this is what, you know, when I was 11, I bought this device, or when I was 12, I got an internship somewhere. And so that all those dates seem to coalesce, you know, around, you know, the late 70s. So that's why I picked the period. So when you pick up the book is, it takes people, it's more like a documentary. You come in with everything happening in the world and man landing on the moon and these kids. These young men are building things at home in kits and learning electronics. And then eventually they go off and do other stuff. But they all eventually end up at Apple. And they build things. Like in 1988, they build FaceTime, phone mirroring. They build Apple TV, all of these things. Because I go, this is what everyone's going to need.
Yeah.
And so they get
it's always been one of these amazing things that a lot of technologies we think are new are not necessarily. They just didn't have their time. No one had a need. Speed and scale wasn't possible, this kind of thing. Many of the technologies you just mentioned even predate that. Bell Labs, Douglas, Engelbert, like a lot of these things were seen decades ago, but just no one.
Yeah, a lot of them.
Why do I need this? You know,
Well, I think that's why. And so there's the other theme that's going on here, which is, you know, we talk about Steve Jobs and his what many people say and some don't that he was able to see what people needed without them knowing they needed it
well,
or wanted it.
And not always, but a lot of the time, yes.
totally not always, right? I mean, one guy, Ron Johnson, said to me, he said, you know, he knew that they had to get across the Unix so that they could do multitasking and proper security and all these things. And he and three other guys were writing Unix for the Mac. And Jobs found out. And he came around and
AUX.
Said, you were to stop AUX, this immediately.
Yeah, which is AUX. Also on the book. Yeah.
This is just prior to AUX. So they're writing it. They're building a server, a Mac server, which they never shipped. And they said, we need Unix for the server because that's how it will plug in. And Jobs comes around and says, you ought to stop this immediately. This is not to happen. You are banned. I forbid. And his words were, I forbid Unix ever being on the Macintosh.
Well, it sort of is now, but not quite. It sort of is.
And I said to Ron, I said, that must have been really hard to like stop and then have to find something else to do. And he said, we didn't stop. So they kept going for another year, and then Jobs got fired. And then someone came along to them and said, let's do AUX.
Always large companies, it's sometimes easy to keep things in the cracks, isn't it?
That's right. Well, they had this whole bunch of people there, say, working in the shadows, and they all talk about it. You know, it's very much this design by subterfuge.
I'd like to just jump around a little bit.
Yep.
Firstly, talk about, I mean, PowerBook is the sort of precursor to MacBooks and things. It was the old line name for Apple laptops. I think that's probably one of the better known names on the list in some respects. I mean, we all know that a PowerBook saved the world in Independence Day as well. But actually, the other interesting one that stands out here is something like LaserWriter. You know, Apple used to make a lot of other hardware. Obviously, they still do, but it's kind of...
Yeah.
There's a lot of hardware that people...
But they don't make hard drives. They don't make hard drives. They don't make printers.
Things, stuff like that, that is not really made anymore. And LaserWriters were very... Yeah. Fondly remembered. Maybe we should talk a little bit about those.
To me, one of the best stories that I found was the PowerBook story. So the PowerBooks, their second portable computer they made, they brought out one called the Macintosh Portable, which was a total disaster. But what happened was that three or four of the guys that were working on the Macintosh Portable did the same thing as many others had done. They said, I just would go in on the weekends and I built what I thought we really should be building. And there was one guy, and he's this recluse and he keeps to himself, and that's how he describes himself. And his name's John Krakauer. And he said the problem that they had with the design was they were copying typewriters where the keyboards or a typewriter is at the bottom of the device. And he said to me, And you know, you have to track these people down using white pages and patents and whatever. And I found him, and he goes, why the hell is an Australian guy ringing me to talk to me about something that happened decades ago? And I said, everyone tells me that you cracked the code for putting the keyboard above where the touchpad is. And he said to me, he said, when I was 14, I used to pack groceries at Walmart to make extra money. And he said, I could watch the groceries coming down the conveyor belt, and I knew where to put them in the bag to get more groceries in that bag. And I thought, holy, whatever. This guy was born to do this. So what he did was he got the hard drive, he got the keyboard internals, he got the processor, and he got the main board, and moved them around until they were in a perfect space underneath the shell. And that format is used in every laptop since the day he put it on his desk.
Yeah.
And he didn't make an extra money for it. He spent months and months and months going around showing people. And they'd say, go away, you're just a crackpot. No one wants that.
I think this is one of those interesting things. It's like, unless you can get an obvious patent, which sometimes is possible, sometimes isn't, a lot of engineers will come up with groundbreaking ideas that, are just,
I mean, yeah. he's one of the, I think I could only find three in the history of Apple where there's only one name on the patent. His is the only name on the PowerBook patent.
Okay.
So I think for him, rather than a financial reward, he still, when I spoke to him, this is like decades later, he still goes, oh yeah, that was, you know, I was pretty happy that happened. You know, they sold hundreds of thousands of these machines.
If you look at laptop sales, full stop, then it's, I don't know, probably billions. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And the LaserWriter team did something which is, it's not really that well known, but I mean, the LaserWriter was basically a Canon printer driver with another Mac, with another Motorola processor. So it was basically another computer.
Screens now, the high-end Apple screens now. Yeah.
Yes, it's exactly the same, right? And people, and that was costing them $7,000 to make them, but Jobs just said it doesn't matter, right? We'll sell them, and we know that in the end we'll make more money out of them that way. But the first LaserWriter only shipped with four fonts, which is just hard. In 2025, if someone told you you could buy a computer, but it could only print four fonts, you would just look at
this is something people forget as well.
Shake your
head. Printers used to have the fonts. Actually, I can't even remember now. I used to, my foray into Apples was actually doing tech support for like printers and magazine companies and things. So I sort of vaguely remember this, but it was a long time ago.
Yes. And so then they added eight more fonts. And then Jean-Louis Gasset, who was then running product development after Jobs left, said, this is crazy that we've got to pay Adobe hundreds of millions of dollars just to get access. We need to write our own fonts. So they built a team and they built all these new fonts. And
I think fonts is one of those technologies that has become so abstracted now. Most people don't really know how they work, why they work. You know, licensing, like the number of times I will go and put together something these days and then look up fonts and then people are like, oh, but are they licensed? I think, oh, yeah. You still actually do need to worry about this sometimes, don't you?
Yeah.
I think most people forget about it now.
Yeah. It seems so arcane, right? Because when we're talking about video editing and video, it's so pervasive. But if you want to use music or you want to use a font, there's still that old school, you got to pay the gatekeeper a dollar.
On a very quick aside, I had a very funny experience on YouTube where I used one of my old music tracks to demonstrate Moises, one of these like AI track extraction things. And I got a takedown notice on YouTube.
Oh,
I
was
like, I wrote this song. And then it went in, and then it came back. It's like, okay, fine.
Was that a person stepped in and said, that's no okay? Or was it a robot? You said, it is, you know, like my father worked for a phone company. And when he came into the business, there was only like one phone, which is in the corridor of your house. And then he lived to 92 when we had iPhones. And I always used to marvel at, oh, look at all the things he's seen, you know, and what cars can do. But, you know, like you and I, if you think about it, I started using a Mac in 1993. And now I'm so at ease with upgrading software, whereas before I was terrified you'd have to boot it up and then one extension would block it, so you'd turn all the extensions off and reboot it, or you'd have hard drives which had little numbers on the back of them and you had to make sure all this, it's all gone, and I can do all of it with the phone, and I'm just thinking I'm living my dad's life. So where did we end up? It's just it is an amazing world of technology, even though Sir Johnny Ive got knighted for putting, you know, the plugs on the back of an iMac, which I never understand.
There's so many more things from the book we could talk about. Maybe we'll have a bit more time for one or two of the more obscure ones in a minute. But the thing I just really wanted to wrap up, because you mentioned it in passing, was like, why was the team got rid of? Do you have any insight into the justification of like why they don't exist any more effectively, or maybe they do, but in a different name, or
I honestly don't. Yeah. I don't know for sure. It had ballooned to being many, many, many people, and they were burning through an enormous amount of money. To give you one insight, there was a guy called Steve Perlman who invented a board that could ingest video at 1080 video in 1987. And he went to his boss and said, I think we can do this. And his boss said, I don't think we can, but this guy really is smart. So let's commission a short run of chips. And that cost them $400,000.
Yeah.
And so there was 200 people in there. I suspect Jobs has said, oh, well, none of those people were his people. And so I suspect he just said, right, let's just wrap up
and this show. A lot of people kind of forget. People have been around Apple for a while, know it, but you know, at that particular point in time, Apple was not the company it is now. They were hemorrhaging money. So
it was bankrupt. It was bankrupt. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it was absolutely bankrupt. And keeping QuickTime, which was revenue positive, because it was doing
what we talked about. I think those were the days when Apple sold core components of software.
Yeah, upgrades. QuickTime Pro, I think, right? Remember, you'd have to go to type in a number and you'd have those bits of paper and sticky things lying around your office to go, oh, we've just upgraded.
Software piracy, those were the days. Anyway, couldn't possibly call it. So let's just, I don't think we have time to go through many of them, but you've mentioned in the blurb for the book a couple of the secret projects. I think some of them sound kind of maybe more obvious than others, but the one that grabs me the most that like, I don't know what this could be, Harpo. What was Harpo?
Harpo was the Mac portable, which they decided rather than making a portable Mac, they decided they were going to put everything from a Mac in something that you could carry. And it sounds like exactly the same thing, but they ended up with a machine that was super heavy. I'm just trying to think what's one like Harpo if we go back around. One thing which kind of went missing, one project that they worked on, which came out of a project called Spider.
I saw that one as well, actually. Yeah.
So what, you know, we talk about QuickTime because we all know that, but what gets lost is it was actually not meant to be about video. It was meant to be about time. And the fact that sound and video run at different frame rates and all this kind of thing, they had to put them together in time. The whole purpose of QuickTime was to trigger events in a time. And now that included the lights in your house. That included notifications. Really? That included things like HomePods. That's what they imagined. But what happened was the company was losing money and hemorrhaging, and they knew Microsoft was about to bring out a Windows video product. So they said, right. They didn't even own the name QuickTime. They had to buy it off someone. And so it's interesting that it's the same as saying a video, QuickTime, back in the day. But it's actually, they could see it out much further, that it was a way of controlling events in a timeline, because there was actually no way to track time on a Macintosh when they started.
I think this is something that people are, another thing that gets forgotten about. We have this, you know, to be honest with you, video formats are kind of done now to a degree. We can argue about one over another, but they're mostly standardized and mostly all available, give or take a few. But back then we had QuickTime, you had Windows Media, you had Reel, you had Flash, like it was options everywhere.
Yes.
And most of them have gone now. .mov, the Apple format, is kind of the only hangover
for
QuickTime, really. So
And what they did was they realized that the only way to get that to work was for their top scientists to get on the organizations that would set the standards. And so they were very aggressive early on, which paid off for them, because instead of having Real Video and all these other formats become sort of bastardizing the market, they ended up owning the market for codecs.
Yep.
And that's why, you know, H.264 and these things, That's why they end up as Apple is still
very powerful in this space. You know, ProRes is a very Apple-specific format, but is already quite widely used in sort of pro editors. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. One little sneaky story is one of their coders was a guy called Rick Arricchio, and he was working. He'd come in on the Apple II, and this was back when this is how small Apple was. The state of California brought in a law that said if you sell or transmit software over a phone line other than physical, we'll tax you. So when they were writing the Unix software for the Macintosh, he had his private pilot's license. He would fly from Cupertino to Portland to a guy in Portland who didn't even work for Apple but had a Macintosh, and that guy would download the software he needed and make a copy for him, and he would physically give it to him at the airport, and he would fly back with it so Apple could avoid paying the state duties on that. And I said to Rick, how many people were at Apple at the time? He goes, oh, thousands. But that's how they thought. They were all hackers. They were all thinking of a way around, you know, the big corporate world that they lived in.
Yeah. I think there's so many more stories we could go down. I love kind of books like this. I mean, I like history, but computing history is also interesting because we kind of still are feeling the effects more directly today. Just even having this conversation, it reminded me of a book I read recently about Bell Labs' lab. I can't remember what it was called, but they had an equivalent kind of thing. And you know, a lot of the technology ended up leaking out into wider use and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, IBM had Thomas Watson and Xerox. Xerox had Park. Yeah. And they all did amazing things. Xerox was super interesting, and everyone thinks they kind of missed the boat by not delivering the PC. Yeah. But one of the guys, Gary Starkweather, they invented the laser printer, which they made more money out of than they ever put into research. So it's a really interesting era. I mean, the book is really just personal stories that overlap, and you see people come and go, and you can see why people invented what they did or didn't manage to finish it off. And it's sort of, I wanted to get it recorded and printed before we end up in an era where everything is just Google and AI'd, and you don't know what's real and you don't know what's real. So you can just, it's in paper and it gets, and one little plug, it gets printed close to wherever you live when you put the order in. And then it gets couriered.
When I bought a copy, I was kind of like, oh, there's no digital option. Okay, I guess I've got to wait. Okay.
We're working on it. Yeah. You know why I'm working on that? Because we get back to this thing of how do we make it so that it can't be copied, but people can get access to it. So I'm going to make it, the EPUB will be free to everyone who's bought the book. We're just trying to work out a way of doing it.
Thanks for introducing me to the platform, because I've put out some books recently and I've been using much more mainstream channels, and I've also spent half my life in Melbourne, and seeing it's a Melbourne company, the company you're using. So it's very nice.
Yeah, it is. They're based in Richmond, and they're probably not your age. They're very smart young guys who don't know anything about fonts or QuickTime.
Well, so I maybe we'll go visit them, and I'm going to hopefully be back in January. So I'll visit them.
But, oh, for sure.
So We should talk. It's Inventing the Future by John Buck, around $30. Actually, it seems to be, that's the price. It's $30. Yeah. Books.buy/John-Buck. I'll put a link in the show notes as well. I think anyone who's interested in Apple history, it's a guaranteed buy. Anyone who's interested in computing history, I'd probably also say the same. But even history in general, I think these stories of where things end up is always a fascinating story, and not really how history is taught quite often. It's usually just like regurgitating numbers and things, not about the threads. So,
that's true.
And do you have a more general website for your other work, or?
I honestly don't. That's just it. There is a ghost website which lets me put up little updates about the book, Inventing the Future at Ghost. But I've really appreciated the chat, and thanks for
thanks for inviting me. So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com.
www.thebrainfarm.com, or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianchiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.